Well, good morning. Thanks for joining us. If this is your first time or one of your first times, we appreciate you coming. I know sometimes it's hard to walk in a new place, and we appreciate you doing that. If you're joining us online, we're grateful that you are with us. So growing up, one of the cartoons I used to watch, I didn't get to watch a lot of TV, but when I did, was Popeye the Sailor. Remember Popeye? Any of you guys remember Popeye? Those of you who don't, thank you. I see you. You're very good. Popeye was a sailor. And he had a foe named Brutus. And every cartoon ended with Popeye and Brutus in some kind of brawl. And man, it was not pretty. Brutus would beat the tar out of Popeye. And as a Popeye fan, you would just be sitting there cringing, what is going on? But those of you who know, what changed the equation in the fight between Popeye and Brutus? A can of spinach, that's right, man, a can of spinach. Popeye put that down, the muscles start flexing, and man, that thing turned around like that. And Popeye, if you let me say it from the pulpit, he kicked butt and took names on Brutus. But up until that can of spinach, you're wondering, man, evil is getting away. And though it's a cartoon, you want it to turn around. Well, sometimes we get people who are evil in leadership. What then? They seem to have all the power. They seem to have all the control. What? The world is replete. The history of the world is full. People, what's our hope when evil leaders thrive? Well, we're going to see an evil leader who gets in power today. And I think at the end of his story, we're going to find out there's a hope for us. So you got a Bible. If you'd open it to Judges chapter 9, we're going to go all the way through this chapter wrestling with this question, what's our hope when evil leaders thrive? We are working our way through the book of Judges, and we've come to understand that judges are not the people with the gavel, bang, bang, but the deliverers. And Israel has been living this cycle, and the cycle is this. They give their heart to some other god, a false god. And we've talked about that. We don't do that with idols. We don't bind to idols, but we give our hearts to money or prestige or power or comfort or whatever it is. And we walk a similar path. And then they give their hearts to this god. And rather than giving them life, this god enslaves them and oppresses them. They call out to God, and God answers in the form of raising up a judge or a deliverer to pull them out of their circumstance. And as long as that judge or deliverer is alive, they follow the Lord and they live in his favor. But that judge or deliverer dies and they repeat the cycle again. We've talked about we're not doing this just so we can get versed on the history of Israel. We're doing it because we tend to live the same cycle. We experience the favor of God and then we wander from that which gave us favor and we live in the discipline of God. And we would like to think we would be people who don't live the cycle. But Israel's, they're a mess. And in this particular case, they had been under the hands of the Midianites. God raised up a man named Gideon, who started great but didn't finish great. But God worked through him and freed Israel from him. And they began to thrive under his leadership. But as happens with every person, Gideon died. So this is what happens at the end of Gideon's life, Judges 8, verses 33 through 35. That it came about as soon as Gideon was dead, the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God. And they knew he was there, but they lived as if he wasn't. This God who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. Nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, through whom God worked, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. So, man, they are done with Gideon. They are back to worshiping false gods, and they're going to start the cycle again. And in the midst of this mess, Abimelech comes to the front. Chapter 9, verses 1 and 2 of Judges says, "And Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal," that's Gideon, "went to Shechem to his mother's relatives, and spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, 'Speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Listen, now here's the catch. Also remember that I'm your bone and your flesh.'" So Gideon, against God's counsel, had multiple wives. All were of Jewish descent except one. He had a concubine who's not legally a wife, but functions as a wife and bears children. She was not of Jewish descent. She was of the people, and she had a son, Abimelech. And Abimelech saying to those people, hey, 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 I'm one of you. What do you think about me as a leader? Let me go back and just catch a snippet of what led up to this, Judges 8, 30 and 31. Now, Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, and here's the problem. He had many wives. One's enough. He had many. On top of that, his concubine, who was in Shechem, she's a woman, a native woman, not legally a wife, but functioning as a wife, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. That's why Israel's in this mess. Gideon supposedly was following God. Long before Judges came about, God had put down a precedent for rulers or kings. This is what it said in Deuteronomy 17:17. He, the king, the leader, shall not multiply wives. One wife for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. So there's the precedent, God's command, leaders, one, and only one wife. Lots of reasons for this, but one is, when that leader dies, who's next up? Well, the oldest son of which wife? If you got multiple wives, they all think, well, it's my son. So now you got competition. And then you throw in this concubine who's not of the people. We don't even get her name. But she's born a son, Abimelech. And Abimelech's playing to the people out there saying, man, I need to be your guy because I'm one of you. What do the people think? Here's what they think. Verse 3. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. And they were inclined to follow Abimelech. And they said, he's our relative. He's one of us. So we'll follow him. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Abimelech has no relationship with God. That doesn't matter. He's one of us. He'll give us what we want. He'll represent us. Well, now, every campaign needs funding, doesn't it? Well, they'll get their funding. Here we go, verse 4. They gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-Berith, which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. So they go to the house of this false god, and they get 70 pieces of silver, and he uses that to hire some mercenaries of worthless people. Give me your thoughts. How's his rule starting out? Going to a false god, getting money there, hiring worthless people. How do you think it's going to go? I'm not feeling good about it. How about you? Well, let's check it out. Verse 5. Then he went to his father's house. Remember, Gideon's his father, Ophrah, and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal. 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. How's he start out? By killing 70 people. You feeling good about this? I'm not. Maybe I'm being a little bit of a pessimist here. But none of that matters to the people, right? Because why? Because he's one of us. He's one of us. It's okay. And he got all, what he's doing is he's getting rid of his competition. Because these sons could challenge him. And he thinks he got them all, but one got away. One got away. The youngest one hid himself and he got away. And he'll come back into play here in just a minute. All the men of Shechem and all Beth Millo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar which was in Shechem. Now here comes the youngest, isn't the youngest brother, isn't he always the pain? Here he comes, verse 7. Now when they told Jotham, he went up and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and called out. Thus he said to them, listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Hey, before you anoint this guy and think, because he's one of you, he's good, listen to me, that God might listen to you. Got to tell him a little story here. Got a little warning for him in the form of a story. So here we go with the story. Verse 8. Once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, no. Shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go to wave over the trees? No, I'm not going. So option number two here. Then the tree said to the fig tree, you come reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to wave over the trees? That's two for two. They've been turned down. Then the tree said to the vine, you come reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my new wine, which cheers God and men, and go to wave over the trees? That's three for three. I'm not interested. So now they've got to go to option four. Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, you come reign over us. The bramble said to the trees, if in truth you're anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. Bramble doesn't grow very high. Doesn't have much shade to offer. So the bramble's not a lot to offer here. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Now, I read commentaries to prep, and man, people are all over the map on what was meant by this story. Here's what I think. I think the first three trees that said no thanks so that they didn't think the people were worth ruling. Will you come be our leader? No. You guys are a mess. I wouldn't want to rule you. So they're scraping the bottom of the barrel. And they get the bramble, who doesn't have much to offer. That's where Israel is right now. 1996 was my last quarter at Denver Seminary. I would graduate that December. But it was also an election year. So imagine that. There was tension in the seminary. Who's the right choice? It was Bill Clinton or Bob Dole. And a seminary professor said this, and he said, please do not read a political position into this statement. But in November, America will get what she deserves. That statement stuck with me. I think Israel, being far from God, is getting what she deserves. And the people's criteria for picking a leader, he looks like us. He's one of us. He'll represent our interests. Well, God's speaking through this younger son, and he's going to speak again here starting in verse 16. Now, therefore, he says, if you have dealt in integrity in making Abimelech king, which you haven't, that's a conditional if, and if you dealt with Jerubbaal and his house, and dealt with him as he deserved. For my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian. But you have risen up against my father's house today and have killed his son 70 men on one stone and have made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem. Why? Because he's so godly? Nope, because he's your relative. If then you have dealt in truth and integrity with Jerubbaal and his house in this day, rejoice in Abimelech and let him rejoice in you. Here's the transition. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo and consume Abimelech. Then Jotham escaped and fled and went to Beer and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. Why would he say what he did in verse 20? How did Abimelech's rule start? In violence. Killed 70 men. Here's what Jotham's saying. You're going to reap what you sow. You are going to feel Abimelech's violence. Violent man's violent man. And Abimelech, in turn, is going to feel your violence. Paul put it another way. You're going to reap what you sow. You start in violence, you'll continue in violence. At Jesus' arrest, Peter reacted. He wanted to save his Savior, and he whips out his sword, and he cuts off the guy's ears. And what does Jesus say? Put away your sword. Why? Because you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Verse 22, now Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. Then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. Imagine that. So that the violence done to 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood might be laid on Abimelech, their brother who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. In one sense, God says, you want to go the route of violence, you go. I'll let you live your choices. Often God's judgment comes in human form. The men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the top of mountains, and they robbed all who might pass by them along the road, and it was told to Abimelech. Man, things are out of control. Imagine that. Things are out of control. Ambush are being set. Robberies happening. Well, this is fertile ground for a new ruler, isn't it? I mean, there's going to be dissatisfaction among the peoples. That's what we get in verse 26. Now, Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his relatives and crossed over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their trust in him. They went out into the field and gathered the grapes of their vineyards and trod them and had a festival. And they went into the house of their god and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. Again, they're worshiping another god. They're drunk. Then Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal and is Zubal not his lieutenant? Certain of men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him? So now we got a rival saying, why should we serve this Abimelech? Would therefore that this people under my authority, he wants to be the ruler. And I would remove Abimelech, and he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. We're going to have a battle. Imagine that, a rival coming up, and he's going to play the card of violence. You're reaping what you sowed. I won't read verses 30 through 33, but Zubal, who's the ruler of the city, lets Abimelech know what's going on. Verses 34 through 41, Abimelech responds and defeats this upstart ruler Gaal. Most of the people are just, they're innocent in there. They're caught between these warring factions. But finally, the battle's over. Verse 42, the people are going to go out to work. Now, it came about the next day that the people went out to the field and it was told to Abimelech, they just want to go do their job. This is an agriculture society. So he took his people and divided them into three companies and lay in wait in the field. When he looked and saw the people coming out from the city, he rose up against them and slew them. Anger, violence, out of control. Then Abimelech and the company who was with him dashed forward and stood in the entrance of the city gate. The other two companies then dashed against all who were in the field and slew them. Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he captured the city and killed the people who were in it. Then he razed the city and sowed it with salt. Just going to work. It's a violent man. And he's still upset about the challenge. So he takes it out on these people. I'm going to summarize verses 46 to 49. There's some people who escape and they go to a tower. And they lock themselves in the tower. And Abimelech gets the townspeople and said, let's cut down branches. And they set a fire in that tower and they kill 1,000 people. It's a violent man. Is this who you want as ruler? But he looks like us. He'll represent us. Well, it's on to the next city, verse 50. Then Abimelech went to Thebez and camped against Thebez and captured it. But there was a strong tower in the center of the city, and all the men and the women and all the leaders fled there and shut themselves in, and they went up on the roof of the tower. So Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and approached the entrance of the tower to burn it, just like he did in verses 46 to 49. But there's a little twist here. In verses 53 and 54, but a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. Then he called quickly to his young man, his armor bearer, and said, draw your sword and kill me, so it will not be said of me, a woman slew him. So the young woman pierced him through, and he died. Kind of a sad passage, isn't it? But Abimelech reaps what he sows. He started in violence, his life ends in violence. We see God working through humanity to bring judgment upon violent people. When the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, each departed to his home. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God returned all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, came upon them. So just a question. How'd that decision look? This guy ought to be our leader because he's one of us. He'll represent us. I mean, he doesn't have a relationship with God, but no, but he's one of us, man. He'll be good. How'd that decision work out for the people of Shechem? Not very good. Let's be careful as we think about leaders. He's one of us. She's one of us. So you have a relationship with God? I'm not even one of us. God will play the final card on these kinds of leaders. See, we asked this question when we started, what's our hope when evil leaders thrive? Here's what I'd say. Evil leaders are subject to the sovereignty and judgment of God, like Abimelech. Evil leaders are subject to the sovereignty and judgment of God. That's the hope we have. But sometimes it seems like they go and they go and they go. What do we take? What do we learn from this? I think Tim Keller summarizes it well. Here's what he says in a synopsis of what went on here in Judges chapter 9. This story exposes the tragic consequences of a people rejecting God's rule. He's got that right. Abimelech is not an anomaly. He's what happens when the human heart, hungry and for power and security, because they're not finding it in God, hungry for power and security, takes matters into its own hands. The people choose him. Why? Because they thought, he's one of us. He'll give us what we want. And the impulse is deeply familiar. We constantly look for saviors who look like us, who we think will give us the life we want. Catch this. Even if they have no relationship with God. We're fooling ourselves. If we think this leader, because he's like us, or she's like us, or she thinks like, or she comes from our side of the tracks, but has no relationship with God, they're going to give us what we want. They're not. See, history is replete, full of leaders who promise peace and power, and they rise to power, but then they end up crushing those who are under them. Full. But this isn't just history, it's theology. It's what happens when we put our ultimate confidence and our ultimate rubric in a leader who looks like us and sees like us and thinks like us, and we don't look to Christ and his values. You know how Judges finishes? There was no king in Israel. So everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And Judges is full of failed leaders. But it doesn't stop in Judges, friends. It goes on to 1 and 2 Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, and it is full of failed kings who lived for self, and they looked like him, and so they put him in power. But you know what? Every failed king is a cry for the true king, for Christ. He is the one and the only one who can bring peace on earth. And his kingdom is started in part, and we'll see it in full when he comes back. But for now, the hope we have is by clinging to this Jesus and following him and measuring every leader, not by what they look like or who they are, but by how they measure up to Christ. See, we were all people in rebellion, like the people of Shechem, the people of Israel. We were in rebellion to God. That's why Christ came, because we said no to God. He lived a life in perfect submission to the Father, right from the point he died on the cross, and he rose from the dead, that we might be restored and we might live in hope of a world ruled in peace and justice. But that starts as we embrace the kingdom of God and we follow him. A reminder, this passage, we'll reap what we sow in every area of life. And we're seeing it with violence today. We put a violent person, we follow a violent person, we will reap that. Maybe some of us step back and said, you know, I've never been violent, I've never been killed anybody, I've never been in a fight, I've never been sorry. I can wash my hands of this. Let me remind you, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount said, you've been angry with your brother, that's tantamount to murder. We're all involved in this. We all need the cleansing that Christ offers. Yeah, it's a text about leadership, but it's also a text about our hearts, the violence in our hearts, the wanting to take revenge, the wanting to get right. Jesus says he is the one who can liberate us from those desires and, yes, even those actions. So it's seventh grade. You guys remember seventh grade? Remember seventh grade? Anybody like seventh grade? Seventh grade. That's the best, isn't it? That's the best. So I'm out at the bike racks, and I had been in shop with this guy named Pat. And Pat and I had a little interaction. I thought we were good, and I was unlocking my bike. And Pat's a lot bigger than I am, I want you to know. And I feel this slug in my back. And I turned around, and Pat is ready to fight. Okay, so if there's somebody ready to initiate a fight at the back bike racks in seventh grade, what happens next, people? Ah, there's a whole crowd that comes around, and they are ready to go down. And I'm quite a bit smaller. I'm not the rock stud I am now. I'm going to lose this. I'm going to lose it big. And I think, you know, there's just a minute or two, I think, this is going to be bad. I'm going to get beat up, and I'm going to be the talk of the school the next day. And this circle is growing. And then you know who steps through? Mr. Woodhouse. He's a history teacher, and he's on bike rack duty that day. Now, like most eighth graders, I didn't like teachers in authority, but I was really glad to see him then. And he says, boys, he looks at us, is there a problem here? No, sir. Do I need to take you down to Mr. Baker's office? Mr. Baker's the assistant principal in charge of discipline. No, sir. Can you boys be going on your way? Yes, sir. And that's it. I was really glad to see Mr. Woodhouse that day. Really, really glad. I want you to know, when we see evil thriving in the world, and it almost seems like there's a cheering section, there is a time. Like Mr. Woodhouse did that day. God's going to break in. And he will set accounts right. He will bring justice. That's the hope we have when evil leaders seem to thrive. Would you pray with me? Our Father in heaven, we're grateful for this troubling story of Abimelech, a violent world, and we understand that we live in a violent world ourselves. And it seems like violence is having its way, and yet you're playing the final card. And Lord, in this, though, we see complicit people. We see people who say, he looks like us, he's one of us, so he's good. I ain't in a relationship with God. Oh, he's one of us, he looks like us, he'll rub. And the people ended up reaping what they sowed. Lord, that as men and women, as we think about leaders in different places, that again, our rubric, our first grid would be, in what ways is this person like Jesus? In what ways is this person not? Lord, that we would understand our ultimate leader is not a human created, but is Jesus, the eternal Son of God. Lord, that we live in that hope. We live in that truth. I pray in your name. Amen.